we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Our top story. The Spanish Prime Minister has said he will not allow Catalonia to go independent.
The streets of Barcelona gridlocked yet again as tens of thousands of people carrying Spanish flags fill the streets of the central Barcelona as yet another day of protest take place here in Catalonia.
We need to declare independence to be on the same political level as the Spanish state.
In the midst of the escalating constitutional crisis that has engulfed Spain over a push for Catalan independence that seems to have erupted out of nowhere, it would be easy, perhaps indeed understandable, to view it in isolation, disconnected from events and crises that have been and are unfolding elsewhere. But do so and we fail to grasp these issues at their common root, which I contend is an ongoing crisis within neoliberalism, this extreme model of global capitalism that has dominated the planet and the lives of those living on it for the past three decades and more. And when it comes to addressing this underlying crisis within neoliberalism, we can do no better, I think, than call upon the analysis of capitalism that was proffered by Karl Marx in the mid to late 19th century, one that has stood the test of time when it comes to taking the measure of an economic system which, despite the propaganda to the contrary, is neither compatible nor even consonant with human nature. At least not if, like me, you believe that cooperation, compassion, and solidarity are the characteristics that make us human, while competition, individualism, and greed make us inhumane. In his Communist Manifesto of 1848, Marx wrote that, and I quote, "Modern bourgeois capitalist society is like the sorcerer who is no longer able to control the powers of the netherworld whom he has called up by his spells." And applying those words to the response of the economic elites and Western governments to the global financial crash of 2008, which gave us the worst global recession since the 1930s, a response that amounted to the intensification of neoliberal nostrums in the form of swingeing cuts to public spending and draconian austerity programmes, and with them the slashing of the purchasing power of the vast majority of consumers, and you arrive at a crisis which, far from being surmounted, has been exacerbated. The evidence in this regard is irrefutable. The Arab Spring of 2011, which quickly morphed into the Arab winter of Salafi jihadism, the emergence and traction of the far right across Europe to an extent not seen since the 1930s, heralding the normalisation of xenophobia, ethno and cultural nationalism, and the demonisation of minorities as part of mainstream political discourse. We've also had Brexit in the UK, the election of Trump in the US, and last but not least, a historical peak in support for separatism in Scotland, Catalonia, and Iraqi Kurdistan, to name but three, each of course taking place in the context of their own cultural, historical, and regional specificities. Attending the march, the mass march and rally in opposition to Catalan independence in Barcelona on October 8th, I was struck by the passions that have been whipped up over what is, when stripped down to its bare essence, a struggle over flags, lacking any definitive departure on either side from the economic system responsible for opening up the very fissures of cultural and national identity that have been rent asunder in every part of the world. Ultimately, more neoliberalism under a different flag is not the answer. As to what the answer is, Marx again said it best, to call on people to give up their illusions about their condition is to call on them to give up a condition that requires illusions. I'm John White and you're listening to Hard Facts. Well, one man who is more than intimate with the inner workings of neoliberalism is Professor Steve Keane, an economist and author, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Give us your analysis, if you will, taking the temperature of the state of neoliberalism, 9 years on from the global economic crash. Where are we when it comes to getting a handle on the economic chaos and crises that have erupted across the planet in the wake of this crisis?
Yeah, I think that we really have, not only don't have a handle on what caused the crisis, we meaning the conventional wisdom, we don't even have a handle on what caused what appeared to be the success of neoliberalism when it was succeeding, apparently, which is pretty much from Maggie Thatcher's rise until the crisis itself. And so if you don't understand what's causing your prosperity, you certainly don't understand what happened, what causes it to collapse at some point further down the track. And the fundamental engine that drove the apparent success of neoliberalism until the crisis struck was an increasing level of private debt, leverage. The reason private debt matters is because credit is the source of a large part of demand. When you borrow money, what you're actually doing from banks is the banks are creating money, creating a debt for you at the same time. You then spend the money you've borrowed. So that additional change in debt becomes a component of demand today. But of course, with that change in debt, that gets added to the level of outstanding debt, and you can have a process where that level rises over time. Now, in the UK's case, in data going back to 1980, which is 13 years after the writing of Das Kapital, from 1880 right through into 1980, there was no trend in the level of private debt compared to GDP in the UK. It never exceeded 75% of GDP. When Maggie Thatcher came to power, it was 55% of GDP. The debt level from Maggie Thatcher rose from 55% of GDP in 1982 to 190% in 2008. And it's then come down a bit since then. The reason the crisis occurred was the rate of growth of debts. It went from positive to negative, and bang, you had a crisis. So the bubble was caused by a rise in leverage. The crisis after it has been caused by the absence of the same substantial level of credit, simply because both households and businesses are unwilling to borrow at the rate they were willing to borrow when the bubble was going on, and the banks aren't so willing to lend either. So we've got a sclerotic effect from the level of accumulated debt. So that's the real story. Because mainstream economics completely omits the role of credit from economics whatsoever and leaves out money and debt and banks in general.
Sorry, Steve, can I just ask you, why do they do that? Why do they omit the role of credit from economics?
It's because they have this mythical model, and Paul Krugman is the main perpetrator of this myth these days. They have a model that banks are what they call intermediaries. They say banks, the way that I describe it is they describe banks as like the Ashley Madison of sex.
They're a facilitator. Yeah,
yeah. That's right. They get a couple together that want to do something behind closed doors, but they don't actually provide the service, but they charge for the introduction agency. That's the model they have. Now, I've been calling that out as part of a tradition of non-orthodox, empirically oriented economists for 40 or 50 years, and they've been ignoring us for all that time. Finally, the Bank of England, the Bundesbank, the Bank of Norway and the Bank of Sweden have all said we're right, the mainstream is wrong.
And I think I'm right in saying that, starting from the 1970s, the real wages declined, but people were able to continue to spend. Their spending power was bolstered by the availability of private credit. I remember when my father, a working class guy, got the first credit card that became widely available in the late 1970s. It was called Access, advertised as your flexible friend. And he promptly went out and bought himself two sheepskin coats. And he thought it was just like real money and didn't realise he had to pay it back. And I think that's a story that can be replicated all across the country and throughout the West, when people suddenly, working class people who had to save for things like coats or luxuries or a car, and they would save over a long period of time and then and thereby sacrifice other things in consequence, they now had the ability, the means to purchase these things. So it was really a case of tomorrow's money today. Now, there is a distinction to be drawn, I think, in what you're saying between private debt and public debt.
Yeah.
I wonder if you would give us an understanding of what that distinction is and why it's so important to this topic.
Yeah, well, the basic logic is quite simple. If you owned your own bank and people accepted checks you wrote on your bank as complete payment of any debt you had, would you feel worried about a large amount of debt? And the answer is fundamentally no, because if you could draw checks on a bank you owned, which paid, as soon as you gave that check to somebody else, they basically wrote off what you owe to them, and they then use that themselves to exchange money with other people, you'd be on easy street.
Yes.
The only danger you'd face is creating so much of the stuff that you caused a bubble, that the economy itself fell over because you were importing too much from overseas and the trade balance exploded and so on. That's the real danger of somebody who owns their own bank spending without limit. But that's fundamentally the situation the government is in. So the government of any region where the government produces its own currency, and of course the UK government has the Bank of England, which produces pounds, and the private banks effectively have the same right to do that, to create pounds by creating loans. But if the government does it, when it does that, it can pay its debts with its own bank. Now, we've put all sorts of legal restrictions on them doing this, but fundamentally, when the Treasury records that it's going to, say, spend, let's say it's going to record it's going to spend £50 billion and it's going to get £45 billion in tax, therefore it has a $5 billion gap, it then issues bonds to the equivalent of £5 billion to pay for that. And let's say it's been charged an interest of 10%, which is far higher than current levels. So £5.5 billion of bonds it issues. Currently, those bonds have to be sold to the private sector, which means there's a transfer from the financial sector to the government of money, and then the government spends that money into the economy. And then, of course, they've got a debt to the financial sector. But that debt is effectively paid for by the central bank, the Bank of England, crediting the accounts of these institutions that own the shares, so they own the bonds they've bought off the government. So it's an accounting operation all the way through. And if the central bank actually bought all the bonds outstanding, which is pretty close to what it's done with QE, then you can actually...
Sorry, QE, you're referring to quantitative easing.
Quantitative easing, yeah. What they've done in that quantitative easing, and this is the point I want people to think about, because it's the little aha objective fact that everybody knows. We know that in, I think it was 2010 or 2011, when the Bank of England began quantitative easing, the amount of money that it created for bond purchases off private banks and off private financial institutions was £200 billion. Now, did you get your part of the QE tax bill that year? The answer is no, you didn't. There was no QE tax. The central bank simply said, we're going to deposit £200 billion worth of money in financial institutions' bank accounts in return for them giving us the ownership of £200 billion worth of bonds, whether they're government bonds or private bonds. So it's just an accounting operation.
Choice.
And exactly the same idea applies to the government financing its own deficit.
Okay, let's call there for a quick break. After the break, I'd like to get into the politics that underpin neoliberalism, or indeed that sit on the foundations of neoliberalism in our time. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back right after this. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of this episode of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with Professor Steve Keen, author and economist, and we are talking about the crisis, the ongoing crisis within neoliberalism, this extreme variant of global capitalism that continues, I think is self-evident, to wreak havoc all across the world. Now, Steve, you went into some great detail and very educative, I must say, into the inner workings of neoliberalism and how the governments and even its most passionate adherents don't really understand what it is they're dealing with. It seems like you're describing, in simple terms, a Frankenstein's monster that's got out of control. Is that a fair summation?
That's a pretty good analogy. What I've actually used zombies in my most recent book, Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? Because, of course, with the attack by Frankenstein, you end up in a grave, and that's the end of you. Attacked by a zombie, you become a zombie yourself. And that's really the state I see of Western economies, because with what neoliberalism allowed the West to do was to use leverage to dramatically add to total demand, but of course adding to debt at the same time. And then when we reach the situation where so many of the ventures which are debt financed went bankrupt, where there was assets that were overvalued and then collapsed and then wiped out the banks in the process, and where people realized that rather than house prices rising forever, they sometimes fall, so you get the hell out of out of mortgage debt. All those things came along. You became the walking dead of debt. And the only countries that managed to evade that fate back in 2008, who had high debt levels, did it by continuing to borrow more private debt, and therefore they're going to become zombies at a later stage with a higher level of debt than the zombies of the
United States. Which countries are you referring to here, Steve, so that we know?
China.
China, okay.
However, you think
China's headed for a crash? Because I was going to come on to China.
They've definitely got to have a credit crunch. The thing is, because they have such a, it's still a semi-state system. It's, you know, the Communist Party still can call the shots there, and there's no way the political class is locked into the financial sector in the way that they are in the UK. So they can switch instantly to government spending. Anybody who complains about that ends up having a lovely holiday somewhere in a strange remote location of Inner Mongolia. So the political capability for them to shift from credit-based spending to government-based spending is huge. But they still have to have a credit crunch. And then the countries which are, because they're totally capitalist, they don't have that easy switch from private money creation to government money creation. South Korea, Canada, Australia, Belgium, Norway, Sweden, and probably also Singapore and a couple of others.
So we've identified the disease, Steve, very eloquently, I must say. What about the cure? What is a cure? How do we tame this beast?
What the beast has done, when you look empirically, is let us get levels of private debt, which are actually the highest in human history, and well beyond what we can service reliably. And also it means that investment and consumption have both diminished dramatically, because people don't want to invest beyond their income levels, which they do during a boom. So the only way to solve it is to get the debt level down. And we've done that in the past. We did it very successfully in a little period called the Second World War.
By spending?
By spending without limit on government expenditure to build things, to drop on other governments and blow the hell out of their countries.
To create income, to pay off the debt, yeah.
Yeah, well, it'd be, in the UK's case, for example, the government deficit in the first year of the Second World War was 40% of GDP. Now, nobody stood up in Parliament and said, we can't afford this bill because it will mean our children will be indebted for the future. Because somebody on the other side would say, we can't afford not to spend this money, because if we don't, your kids will be speaking German.
So this was a demand, you're talking about a demand-led solution to this crisis. The government intervenes because the private sector is no longer investing. It's sitting on a mountain of capital. In essence, it is an investment strike on the part of capitalists, and they're burying the money into the stock market, into the city, and who are now wanting to recycle it by lending it out to private debtors. And this is where the bubble starts. We need a managed response. We need the government to intervene as the investor of last resort.
I actually don't want them as investor of last resort in this instance, because with the scale that's necessary for that to actually reduce the debt level is enormous. And you can do that sort of level of spending politically during something like the Second World War, because it's an existential threat, and nobody in their right mind is going to criticize using government money creation to mobilize as many physical resources as possible for a particular objective that virtually everybody in the society supports. So what you can do is the government pays its own bills with what fundamentally amounts to an accounting operation. They've paid QE, which was fundamentally an accounting operation. And the level of QE, running at £200 billion per year, was of the order of 1/6 or 1/7 the size of the economy per year. That's the scale that they can do. So government money creation could be used for what has been called people's quantitative easing, what I call a modern debt jubilee. Use that money creation capability to give a per capita injection to everybody in the country with a bank account, and use that if they are in debt at all, then the money reduces their debt level. If they're not in debt, they get a cash injection, but that cash injection could also be made conditional on them buying shares from companies that were required to pay their debt levels down. So you could actually use it as a way of using private government money creation capability to effectively rebalance us from a far too much credit, far too little fiat-based money to a more sensible balance of the two.
Steve, but this would also involve obviously a shift in ideology, wouldn't it? Because they've spent the best part of 30 years in demonising the poor, in justifying outrageous levels of inequality, and to suddenly go from that to suddenly say we need to give people money, essentially, to make it easier for people to access money to spend, that would involve and entail an enormous shift in ideology, wouldn't it, to accompany that?
It would, and it's not going to happen. I mean, I get asked this question: what's the best way to do it? I said, well, this isn't my answer, but it is not going to happen for the whole political reason, because Eisenhower created the term General Eisenhower. President General Eisenhower coined the term the military-industrial complex to describe the power of the military system in the United States to distort policy in its own interests. I talk these days about the financial-political complex, because the political system, politicians on across the whole spectrum, and the finance sector are so dominated by the finance sector's perspective, they cannot even consider ideas like this. And of course, it's become part of public belief as well, in blaming the poor for
But what is going to happen, Steve? What is going to happen is what I described is happening, which is separatism in Qatar and Spain, separatism in the UK, Brexit, the election of Trump, the rise of the far right, the conflict and chaos in the Middle East, which I contend are all associated and related to this ongoing crisis within global capitalism.
So yeah, absolutely, because you wouldn't have those revolts if everybody was happy.
Yes.
And
take away a man's need for bread, you take away his need for revolution, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what happened. So the whole belief in the neoliberal project, and the most extreme element of that was the auto-liberal project, which is being imposed on the European Union by fundamentally by the German intellectual class, and people like Schäuble being the main representative of it. That belief meant that what happened and was bad in the global system was catastrophic in the trade deficit sections of the European Union, which of course Spain is one of those sections. And with that poverty that's being imposed there, regions which don't feel well, regions which frankly are part of an ex-empire. The Catalonian, the Basque regions, effectively conquered sections of Spain. And they're saying, well, we're a part of a system which isn't doing us very good. We'd like to get our independence from that, even without any political or economic agenda behind it.
Spending cuts have been imposed, so their people are suffering, while they understand that they are the economic motor of the Spanish economy in proportion to the population there. So it's understandable that this has sown these contradictions that are resulting in an embrace of separatism and the recrudescence of all the old cultural and ethno-nationalist nostrums, and obviously the history of the Spanish Civil War is part of that mix, and you have a perfect storm, don't you?
You do. And this is why people who thought Brexit was the biggest challenge to the European Union, to me it was just a soft little prelude, because I expected entire countries to try to leave the European Union. And that's one that Italy is one country which I think is probably the closest to having a practical way of leaving the euro in particular, but effectively breaking out of the European Union stranglehold on policy in Europe. But of course, the regions are even more so likely to become obstreperous, and because, as you say, all the nationalist stuff, the Catalan flag, et cetera, becomes a rallying point when people are dissatisfied about the absence of bread.
Yes, because it seems incongruous. I said this. I was at the mass opposition rally to Catalan independence on October 8th. Very angry, very ominous. I have to say, massive. It was an all Spain rally. But I came away thinking it seemed incongruous that in the 21st century that separatism is the answer, when we consider that the forces that dominate our lives are global in dimension, economic forces that dominate our lives. And so we're being led down these political cul-de-sacs, and people looking for any kind of change, thinking that any change is better than the status quo, because the status quo is so bad for so many. You mentioned the EU, Steve. Do you think the EU has a future? Can it be reformed? And if it's to be
No, I don't think it can. I mean, I'm on the advisory board, DiEM, Yiannis Varoufakis's DiEM, Democracy in Europe 2025 movement, and I'm happy to be there. But personally, and I've told Yiannis this, I just don't believe the European Union
can
survive.
Be reformed. He wants it to be democratized.
Yeah. Partly my feeling there is just there's an issue about the scale of a genuine country. How big can a country be when there's diversity within that country before political repression becomes necessary to hold it together to stop separatist movements? And China is a good instance of that. There's the Tibet issues, regional issues. They're in the back of the subtext of lots of things happening in China at all times, and in Europe, because autoliberalism has been and had to be a failure because it's based on a stupid notion of macroeconomics, that's led to people wanting to break away, and it's enhanced all those separatist movements.
Steve, I think we're outlining quite a pessimistic future here. Is it that pessimistic?
I think it is. And to my way of thinking, the only thing which is going to get us to address this particular economic problem we've got ourselves locked into is an ecological one, because what led us to get out of the last time we had a crisis, which was the Great Depression, the causes are virtually identical. What got us out of that was the Second World War. There was a substantial level of deleveraging in America during the Great Depression itself, but the fundamental reduction in private debt levels to the stage where the country was not debt encumbered and where the finance sector had been pushed back into being a servant.
But even, before that, Roosevelt brought in his New Deal against huge opposition from Wall Street at the time.
Yeah,
so that it is possible for a government within a capitalist society to actually turn the ship around and start to see the economy as something that serves the needs of society rather than having society serve its needs, as is the case right now, and as was the case in the 1930s when the Great Depression broke, again emanating from the United States. But Roosevelt had the political will. He understood what needed to be done, and he did it in the face of huge opposition. And we need something of that order today, don't you think?
You do, and you don't have it. I mean, you had much more organised working class movements. You had more organised religious movements, because a lot of people who were calling for the New Deal were religious leaders too, who saw the poor turning up at their doors, and they were being expected by the ruling class then to feed the poor, and they said, we simply haven't got enough food and it's about time you did something. And so and of course at the other extreme you had fascist movements, so yes. I think people may, given the recent history, they may well have seen some photographs of National Socialist rallies at Madison Square Garden in New York. So that was the political system in which Roosevelt
and by the way, we have its synonym recently with Charlottesville, similar kind of ugly ethno-nationalist politics, and a recrudescence of fascism, almost the rehabilitation of fascism. We have the rise of the AfD in Germany, which just took seats in the German parliament recently. I mean, this is remarkable. It's a remarkable case of history repeating itself. And when you see the crisis on the Korean Peninsula, the way that Trump is using nuclear weapons as part of his diplomatic bag of tricks and trying to get his way, the conflict with Iran, his intention to pull out of the nuclear deal with Iran, obviously the ongoing crisis in Eastern Europe with NATO troops on Russia's border. It is very, very worrying indeed, and no lessons, it seems to me, have been learned by those in positions of power who really need to learn them the most.
Yeah, there's no capacity for systemic thinking by these people. And actually, the one reason I highly recommend the work of Peter Turchin, who's a historian who's applied the same sort of mathematics that I apply to economic modelling to historical modelling. He has a new book. Oh, it's getting a bit long on the tooth now, about a year old. But it's called Age of Discord. And on his mathematical metrics, where he converts such things as the level of competition over elite places, a whole range of social indicators, he said the only time he's seen a similar level of discord on his models is during the lead up to the Civil War in America.
Wow.
So it really is on that scale of breakdown, with the added flavour, of course, of the ecological threat we face as well, which wasn't an issue back in the Civil War.
That's true. Now, Steve, finally, where can we find your work? Because I think more and more people need to know about the kind of work you do and the analysis that you are offering, which is certainly not as widely known in the mainstream as it really needs to be. Where can people find your work, your website, books, etc.?
Yeah. Well, in terms of books, the most recent book is called Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? That's a little 25,000-worder, so it's actually quite easy to read and very brief. If you want to go for the heavy-duty stuff, my Debunking Economics is about 8 times that long, and that's a much more detailed explanation of why conventional economic theory is wrong. In terms of my active stuff today, I'm leaving the academic sector next year. I've had enough of the neoliberalism of the education system here, and I'm being crowdfunded by a website called Patreon that most people might not have heard of, but it's like a continuous version of Kickstarter rather than one-off. You get people signing up for, say, as little as $1 a month to help out an artist they like, whatever maximum point they like. And on that, I'm currently I've got people paying me roughly half what I earn as a professor. So living in London is not cheap.
So and this is a vacation for you. It's much more than
a
profession.
It's a vacation. Yeah, I need enough to not be able to think about my budget so that I continue doing what I'm doing in this campaign. So if you want to help me out there, it's Patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen. And that's the main vehicle that I use. I'm also now quite happily, and I'm going to be making a few aggressive comments about journalism on this front shortly, quite happily writing a paid column every couple of weeks for Russia Today.
Wonderful news.
Because, frankly, I see Russia Today as having better quality journalism. All this Putin conspiracy stuff drives me balmy. What I see in terms of asking interesting questions and interesting programs, that happens far more in Russia Today than it happens on BBC,
absolutely,
whether they're paid to say it or not.
Absolutely. And I can confirm, just so people know, that Vladimir Putin is not under this desk telling me what to say right now. You've been listening to Steve Keen. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.